dear Brother Ian and my beloved brethren and sisters and our young people. We are very happy this morning to be able to gather in this way, to be able to join together in our lovely breakfast that we've had, the singing of our hymn, and joining together in prayer, and another glorious morning has been given to us to make the most of. And as we look at this chapter, of course, we come to a chapter in which Belshazzar sees the last of his days. And if ever there was a chapter that should teach us to number our days and apply our hearts unto wisdom, surely it must be Daniel chapter 5. It was the last opportunity that this very foolish king had. He was, of course, the last of the kings of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. And on this chart, I've endeavoured to give you the essential history so that we can understand that very important period of time that I spoke to you of as the 70 years of Babylonian ascendancy. The Babylonian ascendancy was the same period as the time of captivity, wasn't it? The 70 years captivity of the children of Judah. So when Zion was down, Babylon was up. And the time was coming now on this night of chapter 5, when the tables should be turned, and then Zion should have a new issuance of life. Now the father of Nebuchadnezzar was a man called Nabopolassar. And before most great men, there was a father of some power and strength of character. And so it was with Nebuchadnezzar. Nabopolassar was a man of considerable power and strength of character. And so when his son came forth, he was coming from a good spring, so to speak, a spring that was going to allow him to have qualities that could greatly expand the kingdom of Babylon, which until that time had not been the preeminent kingdom. It was Assyria, wasn't it, that was the stronger of the two, although they were in the same vicinity and often were in a kind of pseudo-cooperation. So we have the Assyrio-Babylonian period. Nabopolassar, however, was not able to vanquish the Assyrians like Nebuchadnezzar did. And so Nebuchadnezzar brought on that period of very great greatness, very great greatness, and establish therefore the basis for those 70 years that should be eclipsed on this, the final year, a final night of Belshazzar in Daniel chapter 5. As we mentioned before, Nebuchadnezzar reigned for something like 43 years. He conquers the Assyrians and he becomes thus called Nebuchadnezzar the Great. His son was Evil-Merodach, of whom there are two interesting references about the same event, actually. About the time when he lifted up King Jehoiachin. We've already referred to King Jehoiachin, haven't we? He was that one who reigned for 3 months, the third last king of the second last king, I should say, of the kings of Judah, Josiah, and then one for 11 years. What was his name? Jehoiakim. One for 3 months. What was his name? Jehoiachin. One then for 11 years, his name was Zedekiah, which was the one on the south. Jehoahaz. And he was the one for 3 months immediately after Josiah. Alright, so 3 months, 11 years. 3 months, 11 years, that's the way to remember it. Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah. So, when that Jehoiachin was taken off with that very notable number of exiles, the good things, as Jeremiah described them, in his 37th year in captivity, Evil-Merodach exalted him to a throne. He'd been in the prison house until that time. He'd been kept alive. But at that time, Evil-Merodach took Jehoiachin from his lowly position and he gave him a throne, mind you, in Babylon. Because that's what the king of Babylon did. He wanted to see himself as king of kings. He didn't want to have a whole lot of captive kings stuck in the dungeon, so he gave them thrones. He didn't mind that, provided his throne was the throne of thrones. It was sort of an exhortation to his own pride. To have all these captive kings in the city of Babylon, to whom he had given a measure of glory, in that they had their throne, but they were within his own precincts. It was really a very flattering way of elevating their pride, at the same time to elevate his own even the more. And there are little testimonies in the scripture to that description of the thrones that were in Babylon for the surrounding kings. He deposed a lot of them, brought their thrones to Babylon, and over the whole of them he reigned as king of kings. So it was evil Merodach, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, that brought that circumstance to bear for Jehoiachin. The other thing that's interesting is that when he did that, he made Jehoiachin of higher position than the other kings who were in Babylon. That's interesting, isn't it? And he must have done that for a reason. He must have seen that Jehoiachin, he wasn't from an area of great size or prowess, but he recognized, I believe, what had happened to his father, and despite his name, which I'm sure means something different in Hebrew than it does in English, despite his name, he saw a virtue in exalting the king of Judah above the other subjugate kings that were in the city of Babylon. Isn't that interesting? So it might be that Daniel chapter 4 really got into his bones when he saw the remarkable testimony that Daniel put out, Nebuchadnezzar, in that fourth chapter of Daniel, when he sent that remarkable proclamation to all of his kingdom about the greatness of the God of heaven, that he is indeed the king who reigns over all. His kingdom has no limit. He reigns over all nations. What an amazing statement that was. As I have described it, it was the greatest proclamation effort up until the days of the Apostle Paul. For when else was a message of the kingdom of God, the gospel of the kingdom? When was the gospel of the kingdom ever sent abroad to all nations, peoples and languages? Except in the days of the Apostle Paul and in that incredible proclamation of the humble King Nebuchadnezzar after he had gone out and he had for 7 years, as the prophet had told him, eaten straw like an ox. And after that he made that remarkable declaration, sent it to all of his people. Look, I think that's the most absolutely remarkable circumstance, and it may well have been that that's why Jehoiachin was then given that exaltation, because evil Merodach had come to recognize as the son of a great father that there was truth in the God of the children of Judah. Well, evil Merodach came to an evil end, because this gruesome character, a general in the army of Nebuchadnezzar, he rose up and he slew evil Merodach. And however, he had a short end himself. He was there for only about 4 years, as some question about exactly how many years, and his son then reigned in his stead. And his son had given various names. I'll take the easiest one to pronounce: Babashi Marduk. That incidentally is the same as Merodach, which I referred to as the chief god of Babylonians, Bel Merodach. That's his name. So you see that they name themselves after their gods. Nebuchadnezzar has got Nebo in it, of course, hasn't it? As Nabopolassar, no doubt that Nebo also came from the god Nebo, as did Nabonidus. Well, these usurpers were in turn removed by Nabonidus, who had married a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And so then when Nabonidus had a son whose name was Belshazzar, we have here a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Can you see that? Nabonidus marries a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. The son, therefore, is a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And effectively, Belshazzar was the ruler during this period of time. If you add all of those years up together, you'll have some problem, and you'll say to me, Brian, that doesn't make 70, does it? You're a mathematician, you've already done that and found that there's an inconsistency there. Well, the answer to that is this: that for these 40 years, when Belshazzar was reigning, Nabonidus was really the senior monarch in name, but not in presence. He didn't really enjoy administration. What he enjoyed was getting out into the borders of the kingdom and being involved in battles. So he trampled all over the kingdom, always involved in some new battle. He really didn't want to administer the kingdom, but his son Belshazzar knew where power really lay. And so he was much more interested in being at the centre of things in the capital city itself. And so Belshazzar was appointed to be the administrator of the kingdom, the king in that sense. And so there was a co-rulership during those 40 years. So if you take the 40 years off, you're pretty close to 70. And within the limits of what we're able to be dogmatic about ancient history, we're pretty close to 70. Is that right? So there is the very important list. I found that very helpful to get that clear in one's mind as to what kings were upon the throne of Babylon during that period of time. It's not difficult to get that all sorted out in their mind. Now I want you to have a look at a passage on the life of that in Jeremiah chapter 27. Quite amazing passage. You know how it says of Jeremiah that he was appointed over kings. Jeremiah chapter 27 and verse 7. Always remember those years, 606 to 536, that's 70 years, isn't it? Being BC years, we count backwards. 606 to 536, period of 70 years, which is in agreement with Jeremiah's 29th chapter, where he said the Jews would be in captivity for 70 years. That's really helpful to get that little concept in your mind. You can begin to build upon that, then bring the rest together in a clear picture. Alright, Jeremiah 27 and verse 6. And now have I given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. And the beasts of the field have I given him also to serve him. Which is rather ironic when you think that later on he came and competed for the straw with the beasts of the field. Nevertheless, verse 7, and all nations shall serve him and his son and his son's son until the very time of his land come. And then many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of him. So there was a very distinct limitation placed upon the kingdom of Babylon until the very time, says Jeremiah, of his land come. And the fact that it's mentioned so specifically makes you wonder, even at that stage, if God did not have, as it were, a night in mind in which that kingdom would come to an end. And so, when we look at that chart, we're looking at the situation of his son, Nebuchadnezzar, his son. And then after a couple of usurpers, it was his son's son, his grandson, Belshazzar, who then reigned for a period of approximately 14 to 15 years. Those times are not exact because we can't be overly exact about them. So that's a very remarkable fulfillment, isn't it, of the exact words of Jeremiah 27. There'll be three generations and then the very time of his land will become. Now I want to show you four remarkable passages. You know what our reading was this morning from that fifth chapter of Daniel. You know the basic story of it. We all know that. We learned it at Sunday school. This dramatic night in which the king was at feast and suddenly, bang, the kingdom was taken from him. The Medo-Persians are upon him. Now I want you to have a look at four absolutely astounding prophecies. The first is in Jeremiah and it's in verse 24. This is in those chapters 50, 51, 52 which have to do with judgments against Babylon. Jeremiah 50, verse 24. Alright, Jeremiah's 51st and 52nd chapters are about the judgment upon Babylon. And here in Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 24, we have a section dealing with that. How was the hammer of the whole earth cut asunder and broken? Verse 23. See, God had used that hammer to bring about his judgments upon certain other people. There he, in very graphic figure, speaks of Babylon as the hammer of the whole earth. But how is the hammer of the whole earth cut asunder and broken? He sees in vision. How is Babylon become a desolation among the nations? I have laid a snare for thee, and thou art also taken, O Babylon, and thou wast not aware. It was going to catch Babylon completely unaware. Thou art found and also caught, because thou hast striven against Yahweh, the God of Israel. Look at that passage in the light of what happened. How's the mass, Rob? How about that passage in the light of what happened? Isn't that a remarkable passage? Thou art found and caught because thou hast striven against Yahweh. What were they doing that night? That's a remarkable statement, isn't it? In Isaiah, when we go back to Isaiah, we go back 100 years, which makes this, in a sense, all the more remarkable. In Isaiah chapter 21, in verses 4 and 5, this prophecy, in Isaiah 21, in verses 1 to 10, is about the overcoming of Babylon by the Medes and Persians. See verse 2, halfway through. Go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media, all the sighing thereof have I made to cease. Verse 3, therefore are my loins filled with pain. Pangs have taken hold upon me, as the pangs of a woman that travaileth. I was bowed down at the hearing of it, I was dismayed at the hearing of it, at the seeing of it. That is to say, the prophet Isaiah said, when I heard this message, The awe of the message brought me to a sense of shaking loins. I was very moved by the greatness of the vision that I had seen. Pangs had taken hold upon me. He felt the tremendous implications of the statements that he was making, of the vision that he was seeing as he saw those Medes and Elamites pouring through to take the great kingdom of Babylon. Verse 4, my heart panted. Fearfulness affrighted me. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me. And that's not the prophet having a night of pleasure, is it? That's what he saw. He saw a night of feasting, of pleasure and happiness and joy, of all the lusts of the flesh. The night of the pleasure was turned into fear unto me. And we well remember the picture up in Daniel chapter 5 of the concern of Belshazzar on that night. What an amazing statement. The 13th chapter. The fall of Babylon was clearly seen by the prophets of Israel and written over 100 years. In fact, Isaiah to Belshazzar's time is 70 plus 100. It's about 170 years earlier than the event came to pass. In Isaiah chapter 13, another chapter which has to do with the judgment of Babylon. Do you see verse 1, the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos did see? Alright, verse 5. He's watching the battle now by the vision of God. They come from a far country, even from the end of heaven. Even the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. How are ye, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It shall come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore shall all hands be faint. and every man's heart shall melt. Remember the kings? Remember the atmosphere of lascivious entertainment that was turned into an atmosphere of fear and trembling? They shall be afraid. Pangs and sorrow shall take hold on them. They shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth. They shall be amazed one at another. Their faces shall be as flames. That's the very description that is given of Belshazzar that night. His countenance was greatly changed, wasn't it? What amazing passages they were. Wonderful. Wonderful testimony to the accuracy of our Bible. Absolutely wonderful. Jeremiah chapter 51 now, our fourth reference. In turning to Jeremiah 51, we're back in those three chapters which have to do with the judgment of Babylon. 50, 51 and 52. And so in verse 39, verse 37 makes it clear it's a chapter which has to do with the destruction of Babylon. Babylon shall become heaps, a dwelling place for dragons, an astonishment and a hissing without an inhabitant. They shall roar together like lions, they shall yell as lions whelps. In their heat I will make their feast, and I will make them drunken, that they may rejoice and sleep a perpetual sleep and not wake, saith the Lord. And what was Belshazzar doing that night? And all of his thousand lords having a great party and drinking themselves drunk. In the midst of all that frightful lasciviousness, in the midst of their heat, God says, I'll make them drunken that they shall sleep a perpetual sleep. What an astounding, absolutely astounding verse. Because that's exactly what happens. After this year, the kingdom of Babylon is no more. It never rose again. It was never found among the kingdoms of the earth again. In the 57th verse, finally, of this same chapter, verse 56, to bring us in again, because the spoiler is come upon her, even upon Babylon, and her mighty men are taken, every one of their bows is broken. For the Lord God of recompenses, the God of judgment, in other words, that pays back in the right time, the Lord God of recompenses shall surely requite, and I will make drunk her princes, and her wise men her captains, and her rulers. They're all there, the whole 1,000 of them, and her mighty men. And they shall sleep a perpetual sleep and not wake, saith the King, the King. Notice that lovely description. The King, whose name is Yahweh of hosts. Isn't that lovely? There he was, King of kings, he thought. There he was among all of his lords, the kings of other nations. And the prophet so beautifully describes it. Saith the King, whose name is Yahweh of armies. What a lovely, meaningful, sensitive description that is. It was probably a religious feast in which the king was involved. We turn over now to our chapter in Daniel chapter 5. Herodotus, the famous historian, who in fact came into Babylon only 70 years after its captivity and saw much of the original glory and made a most interesting account. Herodotus' history is a very interesting record of these times. He says it very likely was a religious festival. It was probably the time of the harvest of the grapes, and so they were celebrating in this way, and wine always played a very large part on the table of ancient kings. And of course that would have been known to Cyrus, wouldn't it? And therefore a good time to set about one's attack would have been at the time of the celebration of this religious feast of wine. But it was a very bad example that Belshazzar was setting in drinking wine before all of his ministers of state and other lords. You know, there was a little piece of advice given to kings about wine in the Proverbs chapter 31. Proverbs 31, and we'll read it down from verse 1. The words of King Lemuel, whom we believe is a pseudonym there for Solomon. The words of King Lemuel, the prophecy that his mother taught him. It's a bit of old advice from his mother. What, my son, and what to the son of my womb, and what to the son of my vow? You know, that's the treasure of a son, isn't it? He's the son of her womb. He's the son of the vows that she made in marriage. She's his pride. That's why children are loved by their parents. That's why we want to give them good advice and not see their ways. Fall upon the rocks. Give not thy strength unto women, nor thy ways to that which destroyeth kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes, plural, strong drink, as they would like to do, all gathering together and showing how much they could consume, and then all getting happy one with the other, and losing the sense of counsel when all the administration of the empire revolves around them. There's an empire to be run and administered properly. It needs sober-minded people, and people of sound judgment. And his mother could see, don't go down that way. Stay away from those types of things. Not for kings, O Lemuel, not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law, and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. How applicable that becomes to Daniel chapter 5, as we shall see. Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish. Isn't that an amazing statement? Ready to perish, as Belshazzar was that night. And wine unto those that be of heavy hearts. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. But for you, O king, upon whom the mantle of responsible government rests, it is not for kings to drink wine. Quite an amazing statement again in the light of Daniel chapter 5. When we try and visualize the terms of verses 1 and 2, it really is quite a remarkable feast, isn't it? Great feast to a thousand of his lords. Can you imagine that? And I suppose all their women were there too. It was a great occasion. And each one dressed up in his very best. A very special occasion. And all trying to outdo the other. Can you imagine what the women looked like? All trying to outdo each other. Thousands of them. Goodness me. Can you imagine also the atmosphere of these lords, many of whom had come from other lands, and trying to outdo each other in terms of position and prominence? And all around them was the army of the Medes and Persians. They knew that. Couldn't care a bit. They had walls that went up 160 feet. They were so wide you could drive 4 chariots along the top of the walls. Why worry? There was an area of hundreds of square miles contained within the walls of the city. Why do we need to be worried? And besides, we have this magnificent river, the River Euphrates, that goes right through our city, and from that we take off our water on either side, and we irrigate all our plots. We have no worries. Cyrus will get hungry before we do. And Cyrus at that time was on the move. Cyrus came from the east, from a small kingdom called the Kingdom of Anshan. It was one of the Aryan peoples, as they were called at that time, and they inhabited the low part of the Persian plain, the Persian plateau. You know, Iran today, look at it in our Bible, so you've got a better concept of it. Iran today is a high country. It's like the Rand, if you like. Here's the pun on the word, but it's like the Rand here. You know how it's lifted up to plateau, isn't it? Well, Iran is like that. It's a very high piece of country. Can you see it there? Got it clearly in your mind? And there's a very strong range of mountains that run from the top of the Persian Gulf. Have you got that map which has got the Persian Gulf on? The top of the Persian Gulf. Well, if you just go a little bit east of that, that's where the kingdom of Anshan was. Not which map? A map which shows the area of Persia right across to India. Well, your map might not go right across to India, but mine does. And shows the Persian Gulf. How the people saw his achievements. So now Cyrus has gone right to, we'll describe more of that when we come to chapter 7 tomorrow morning. He's gone right towards the east and the west. He's gone right to the Aegean Sea, and now he's come back. And between the branches of the river Euphrates, here's Babylon, between the branches of the river Euphrates, they built a Median wall. Well, the Medes are not there. The Medes were up there. But they knew the only way the Medes could come was through that river. Were through the branches of that river, and so they built a Median wall. And they still were not perturbed, even when that was broached. And the army had come and set all around them. Belshazzar says, we had a feast on the program, we will have a feast. So, completely unmoved by the presence and by the achievements of the Medo-Persians to this point of time, he decides that he's still going to have this feast, and so he fills them all up with wine, as though it's just like the good old days. So Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. It was the zenith, you might say, of the Babylonians' achievements. And it says in verse 2 that Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father, and you notice the margin more rightly says his grandfather, see, his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, that the kings and his princes, that the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines might drink therein. I don't know how that verse appeals to you, but the more you think about it, it almost makes you feel sick, doesn't it? What were these vessels? We already had reference to them in chapter 1, didn't we? And we learnt there that the vessels were like the people that they represented. Verse 2 of chapter 1, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the house of Shinar, into the land of Shinar, to the house of his gods, that he brought the vessels into the treasure house of Merodach, his god. And that was like the king's children of Judah, verse 3, that came at the same time, those holy vessels, speaking in symbol of the holy people of God, that were taken from Jerusalem at that time and brought that they might serve the interests of the king of Babylon and his heathen gods. In Jeremiah chapter 52, we are told that it was not just a part of those vessels, but all of them that were eventually taken. Jeremiah chapter 52. There were thousands of these vessels, I might tell you, my dear brothers and sisters. In Ezra chapter 1 and verse 7, it gives an account there of the thousands of these vessels, which must have been very beautiful and of no doubt very considerable worth. Jeremiah 52 verse 17, it describes here now how Nebuchadnezzar, in his 19th year, this is his final invasion against Jerusalem, when he completely ransacked the city and took the captives away. Jeremiah 52, also verse 17, also the pillars of brass that were in the house of Yahweh, and the bases, the brazen sea that was in the house of Yahweh, the Chaldeans break. You know, what arrogance to go into God's house like that. What a crude arrogance. The Chaldeans break and carried all the brass of them to Babylon. More than that, the cauldrons also, and the shovels, and the snuffers, and the bowls, and the spoons, and all the vessels of brass wherewith they ministered, and took they away. There were vessels for the incense, and vessels for the blood. There were vessels for the drink offerings, for the containing of various measures of flour and so forth, all that was involved in the worship of the temple in Jerusalem. And the basins, verse 19, and the fire pans, and the bowls, and the cauldrons, and the candlesticks, and the spoons, and the cups. That which was of gold in gold, and that which was of silver in silver, took the captain of the guard away. The two pillars, one sea, and 12 brazen bulls that were under the bases, which King Solomon had made in the house of the Lord so long before, the brass of all these vessels was without weight, and it was all carried off to Babylon. And it rested in the house of those gods until this first class idiot had the blasphemy that he should take those vessels that originally had served in the house of the living God in Jerusalem, and he would not have them just there for decorative purposes in his own house, but he would put them to practical use in his evil feast, as he is that night in defiance of the God of heaven, having a great banquet on the very night of his destruction. And the last token of defiance that he can make against the God that his father had once said, his grandfather once said, is the God of gods whose kingdom will never depart. He then takes the vessels of that God's house, and he says that I will let you all have these. And he spreads them out among the beasts. Can you imagine it? As servants were sent, and they came back with baskets and baskets of these glorious vessels that no one had had the disdain to use in that way before. They had golden vessels? Of course they had golden vessels. Do you think the king of Babylon would have found it difficult to find enough silver and gold to have vessels for drinking purposes? Of course not. Why then did he decide that at this time he should go and get those vessels? Because he thought that he was smarter than the God of heaven. He had exalted himself above him. That's the clear implication of taking those vessels. Nor did he mind that not only he should partake of them, but his princes as well, right down to his wife, and not only that, his jolly concubines were drinking from those vessels that once had been the vessels used in the holy service of Yahweh, the God of Israel. Can you imagine, my dear brothers and sisters, the reaction in heaven above to that type of thing? You know, we said before, on the basis of 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 20, do you remember that reference? That the vessels stood for people, didn't they? Remember that? In a great house there are many vessels, some to honour and some to dishonour, some of gold and some of silver. Alright, so the vessels stand for people. What are the golden vessels therefore of Yahweh? Are they not his jewels? His precious jewels? Not jewels, of course, but people. His chosen people, like the prophet Malachi expresses it. Malachi chapter 3. In verse 17, They shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts. Malachi 3 verse 17. In the day when I make up my jewels, my special treasure, says the margin, I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. So those vessels were like the cream, the spiritual cream. Those of tried faith, as the word, as the metal gold symbolizes. You know how you make gold and you purified it in the fire, and that's why it was so precious, because a lot of work had gone into preparing that, and then you moulded that for the right shape. And so that lovely, pure golden vessel, shaped to perfection, was like the perfecting of God's children, His loved children, that served Him with all their faith, looking towards Him, and there was a ring of purity in their ways before Him. They were more precious than of gold, though it be tried in the fire. That's what they stood for. In a sense, it was as though the filthy concubines of Belshazzar, all his multiple of wives, were disdainfully using God's servants, men like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and would with disdain use them, God's own servants, in the times of their lasciviousness. And you know, that's what they were doing. Because within the kingdom of Babylon at this time, there were many of the captivity of Judah, and they were brutally pushed underfoot or ignored, including which was Daniel himself. And one of the beautiful things of this story is that that beautiful golden vessel of God, Daniel the prophet, is going to be brought into that feast when all others have failed. They have tried to drink out of the vessels of knowledge of every other god and found nothing, and they will have to come and take of the knowledge of Daniel. Eventually, it comes to that. Alright, what Belshazzar did not realize as he was gobbling down his wine in front of all of his servants is that the God of heaven had prepared for him another cup. And I want you to come to what was not quite a contemporary prophet now, but had been a contemporary prophet of Daniel, the prophet Jeremiah, to a reference which in the circumstances is quite remarkable. Jeremiah chapter 25. Jeremiah 25 and verse 11 speaks of the desolations which Babylon would exercise upon other nations, and in particular upon Judah for 70 years. Verse 12, it shall come to pass when 70 years are accomplished, that God will turn the tables. I will punish the kingdom of Babylon and that nation, saith the Lord, for their iniquity, and the land of the Chaldeans, and will make it perpetual desolation. See what I said before? 70 years of Babylonian ascendancy would be the time of the depression of the children of Judah. And after that, God would turn the tables upon Babylon. So verse 15. Verse 13. I will bring upon that land all my words which I have pronounced against it, even all that is written in this book which Jeremiah hath prophesied against all the nations. For many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of them also, and I will recompense them according to their deeds and according to the works of their own hands. Let the nations remember that today. Let Russia do that. Remember that today. When she keeps God's people back from the land of their fathers, let them remember that God sees all, and He will recompense them according to their deeds and according to the works of their own hands. For thus saith the Lord God of Israel, verse 15, unto me, take the wine cup of this fury at my hand, and cause all the nations to whom I send thee to drink it. And they shall drink, and because it's a cup of judgment, they shall drink and be moved and be mad because of the sword that I will send among them. So Jeremiah takes the cup in this interesting little picture. I took the cup at Yahweh's hand, and made all the nations to drink, unto whom Yahweh had sent me. Who was the first to drink of that awesome vessel? It was Jerusalem, verse 18. Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. Judgment begins at the house of God first. 1 Peter 4 and verse 17. But it didn't stop there. See verse 19? It went to all nations, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And so on down in verse 20, Ascalon among the Philistines. Verse 21, Edom and Moab. Tyre and Sidon in verse 22. Dedan and Teman in verse 23. These were all the kings that Babylon subdued. This was a lot of the work of Nebuchadnezzar and Nabonidus, who went round victory after victory, achieving victory after victory in the kings that were all around them. And so verse 26, and all the kings of the north, far and near, one with another, and all the kingdoms of the world which are upon the face of the earth, and the king of Shishak, who seems to have been forgotten as he's meeting out judgment one after the other upon all the other nations of the earth. The king of Shishak, which is the king of Babylon, if you want a reference for that, Jeremiah 51 and verse 41 tells us that Shishak is Babylon. The prophet then inserts that right at the end, and the king of Shishak shall drink after them. Therefore thou shalt say unto them, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, drink ye and be drunken, the sword which I will send among you. And it shall be, if they refuse to take the cup at thine hand to drink, then shalt thou say unto them, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, ye shall certainly drink, if I bring it upon the city of Jerusalem that is called by my name. Do you think you will escape? For lo, I begin to bring evil on the city which is called by my name. And should ye be utterly unpunished, ye shall not be unpunished. For I will call for a sword upon all the inhabitants of the earth, as saith the Lord of hosts. So, who drinks of the cup last? It is the king of Babylon. And which is the worst portion of the cup? It is the bottom of the cup, where the dregs were, where the taste was bitter among the dregs. And so it was the bottom, where the dregs of the cup were in this cup of judgment, that Babylon was to partake. And so there is Belshazzar. What an irony. He's partaking of this most delicately prepared wine, from the best of his wine producers. And he's tasting it in front of all of his people, in all the splendor of his glory, the zenith of his power, he thinks, in absolute disdain of all the Medo-Persians outside. And what he doesn't remember is he's really partaking of the dregs of the cup of judgment of Yahweh himself. There was another cup prepared. So there's some very wonderful overtones to this night of the Feast of Belshazzar. So we read in verse 3, they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. Daniel 5 and verse 3. There were thousands of them, as I mentioned, that were taken out of the vessel of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines drank in them, the ultimate insult to the God of heaven. And look what they did in verse 4. As they drank, they praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. And you know, there were gods who were literally called the god of gold, the god of silver. Merodach was the god of gold. There were others who were called the god of silver, and the god of brass, and the god of iron. Isn't that interesting? How interesting that was. And they're all mentioned there in verse 4. But apart from that, all the gods of the nations were made up of those things, plus wood and stone. And the other interesting thing at this time is that when Nabonidus had gone around to all of these surrounding nations, Belshazzar had said to him, look, we want to have here in Babylon a representative of all the gods of the nations, so that in Babylon we have great security. Because, well, we've got all the gods here. See? Of course, Herodotus said that Merodach he said that Merodach, who was the god of Babylon, the patron god of Babylon, must surely have been annoyed because of all these other gods coming into Babylon, because it was sort of usurping his own authority. Such was the thinking of the time. But Belshazzar was trying to seek a way by which they could thwart the advancements of Cyrus, who was at the head of the Medo-Persian forces. And so Nabonidus had been asked to send to Babylon all the various gods of the nation. So they're all sitting in Babylon at that time. Babylon was a hodgepodge of religion. The pantheon of heathen gods was all now contained within the walls of Babylon. And so they thought, well, how can we be, invaded? We've got every god on our side here in this principal city. And so as they drank wine, they praised the gods of gold, of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. Isn't that an amazing historical note? All gathered in there together at that time. And then verses 5 to 9, we have the handwriting by the finger of God. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand, and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote, and he was troubled. Apparently not all of it was visible. We read it, understand that, from verse 24. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. But it was sufficient to greatly trouble him. You know, the Ten Commandments were written by the finger of God in Exodus chapter 31 and verse 18. And as the king saw this, looking up from his feast, his glass in his hand, so to speak, or his goblet in his hand, the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against each other, just like that 30th chapter of Isaiah had said in verses 7 and 8. Just like the world today, that fear for those things that are coming upon the earth. And the king cried aloud to bring in all those that have been found to be such a failure in the past, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet, which of course is the colour of royalty, and have a chain of gold about his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. And the reason he could only be the third ruler is that Nabonidus was the first, Belshazzar was the second, and therefore the next one appointed would have to be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then came in all the king's wise men, but of course they were unable to help. Then verse 9, King Belshazzar was greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. And then in verses 10 to 12 we have the queen's counsel. It seems that she was probably the wife of Nabonidus, or perhaps even the wife of Nebuchadnezzar, one of his later wives, that well remembered the times of Nebuchadnezzar. Her memory went back. Clearly she was a woman of different disposition to those others that had been gathered. And also clearly she was not the queen of King Belshazzar. Otherwise she would have been mentioned as in verse 2, or included in verse 2. She is somebody outside of those others gathered in verse 2. She must belong to a previous generation, probably to Nabonidus, or I feel particularly she might have been a younger queen of Nebuchadnezzar, and therefore was still around at this time, but had a clear recollection of earlier time. O king, live forever. Verse 11, there is a man in thy kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of thy father, which is no doubt the grandfather of verse 2, Nebuchadnezzar, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, thy grandfather, the king, I say, thy father. And the very fact that it's put that way, it shows how great was the memory of Nebuchadnezzar. He was the king. Belshazzar was a king, but Nebuchadnezzar was the king. I say, thy father. made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans and soothsayers. She remembers it very well. Daniel chapter 2 and verse 48 confirms that, how that he was put over all the others of the wise men of Babylon, because, verse 12, an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding and interpreting of dreams, showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, in the king named Belteshazzar. She said, let Daniel be called and he will show the interpretation. And so Daniel is brought in to the trembling king. And he says, verse 14, I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. He says, I've tried all my other men, verse 15, who he should have known from the history of the times were a complete failure. He did know that. He was perfectly aware of that. Daniel tells him that in verse 22. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. When the queen was making those words to him, from that earlier generation to him and this time, it was not that he did not know that, but that he willingly had put that information behind him. He knew that Daniel existed. He knew of the decree of his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar. He knew all that, said Daniel. So Daniel reiterates to him some of the relevant history of the kingdom of Babylon. Look, he said in verse 17, I don't want your rewards, but I will let you know the meaning of the writing. O thou king, verse 18, the Most High God gave your grandfather Nebuchadnezzar a kingdom, majesty, glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would he slew, whom he would he kept alive, whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. He was sole monarch, undisputed monarch of the world. But when his heart was lifted up, look at the incident that he recalls to Belshazzar. And here's the king, amidst all of his cronies, amidst all of his wives and his concubines. Here's the king in this time of great splendor, now being defaced by the sober words of this aged man of at least 84, perhaps 87 years of age. For 70 years have now passed by, haven't they? 70 years have passed by. If he was brought in at 14, he was 84 years of age. If at 17, he was 87 years of age. This old, wizened up man is brought in. And here's this great banquet of lasciviousness. And although he's the most important person in that realm, he hasn't been so much as thought of at this banquet. And as he looks at the tables, of course, he sees the holy vessels with which he came back so earlier, so back some 70 years earlier than that time. And he sees all this in front of him. And he reminds Belshazzar of his grandfather. When Nebuchadnezzar's heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him. And he reminds him of that particular incident in chapter 4. He was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointed over it whomsoever he will. You knew all that, Belshazzar, but you have willingly forgotten what your grandfather and your father perhaps had told you. Thou now, verse 23, hast lifted up thyself, like Nebuchadnezzar did in verse 20. Thou hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords and thy wives, and Daniel saw the whole scene, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them, and thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, brass, iron, wood and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. And so in verse 24, the writing was made more clear. The part of the hand was removed, as Rotherham indicates it was. And so Daniel saw the writing clearly. So he gives the interpretation in verses 26 to 28. this is the interpretation of the thing. Meaning, that means that God hath numbered. It means the word number, doesn't it? Meaning means numbered. Meaning, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tikel, thou art weighed. That's what the word means. A reference there to Jeremiah 50 and verse 24 shows how exactitude that was in the prophet's earlier words. He said that Babylon would be weighed. Tikel, thou art weighed. In the balance, it's not found wanting. Heres, thy kingdom is divided. That's the word. And given to the Medes and Persians. Interesting, you know, because the word Persians is almost the same as the word Heres. And so the Persians were divided, the kingdom of Babylon. And so Belshazzar appointed Daniel to be the third in line. He didn't give him the rewards. He'd asked not for those, but then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. But his elevation even higher was almost immediate. In that night was Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Although we've got no time, I just want to leave you with a very interesting thought. He was number one, he was number two, Daniel was number three. The Medo-Persians came into the city, they slew Belshazzar that night, they found Nabonidus, who happened to have returned to Babylon, they found him and they slew him. Who was number one? Who's in charge of the kingdom? Daniel. Daniel must have been. He's the man with the golden chain, which from the days when Pharaoh gave such to Joseph, illustrated that he was the prime minister. He was now in control of the city and the kingdom of Babylon. At the very time that the Medes and Persians came into that city, the man they had to deal with was none other than this 80-odd-year-old man, Daniel the prophet, who was the golden vessel that had succeeded when they had disdained the vessels of God. In that very night, he is elevated to a very glorious position. And when Cyrus looked in the midst of that city to find out who it should be that he should negotiate with and speak to concerning the taking over of the city, it would have been to Daniel that he would have come. Now there's some thought for consideration. What do you think, my dear brothers and sisters, would have taken place then? What would Daniel have told him as he made inquiry about this strange and remarkable old man? How come this foreigner is your king? Where did he come from? Why is he now being suddenly elevated? What were the circumstances of the previous night? Where has this man come from? What did he say to the queen, the aged queen, that had been back in the times of Nebuchadnezzar, as he began to meet the notorieties of the city? So Cyrus, we understand, had some basis, didn't he, for that glorious proclamation that he would make in the very same year, that there should be an opening up of opportunity, the children of Judah, that they should return unto their people. Such is the ways of God in bringing recompense in his own time. That's a very exciting story, isn't it?